I'm Ryan Macklin from Master Plan. Many have tried to read it, but the wisest know to listen to the tome.
Welcome to The Tome, episode 67. The Tome is a D&D news, reviews, and interviews show, and I'm your Tome host, Jeff Greiner. In this episode, we will be creating new worlds and filling it with horrible baddies in the 4th edition Dungeon Master's Guide and Monster Manual. This is part 2 of the dual review I did with William Paul on the new 4th edition core rulebooks. You just listened to the Player's Handbook review that came out one day before, so I'm throwing all kinds of crazy tome content at you here just before I head off to Origins, which is happening tomorrow. So don't expect any episodes until after the convention is over, but I do have several things in the can almost ready to put out, plus other things planned, plus all kinds of Origins goodness that I'm hoping to bring back to you, so look out for all of that. I've also been thinking about doing some occasional advice episodes regarding 4th edition rules to help people get used to this new system. I've been asked on occasion through emails and on the forums to do advice sections for the podcast, and I've always sort of done a little bit, but really very, very little bit. And part of that has been because with 3rd edition, by the time I started this show, 3rd edition had been out for a long, 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 long time. And I sort of had the feeling that most people had a really firm grasp on how 4th edition stuff, or not, on how 3rd edition D&D was played. But with a new system coming out, there's a lot of room to talk about how to make the best warlock or the most interesting dragonborn character I've seen and some of these kinds of things. So we might be doing some of that in the future, and I'd be anxious to hear some of your feedback on the forums over at thetomeshow.com. Speaking of thetomeshow.com, awesome segue, Jeff. Well, thank you, Jeff. Don't forget to participate in the Tome's Summer 2008 contest. Click the link that says contest at thetomeshow.com and answer the 5-question survey. It's that easy. The contest has only been out for one day and it's already going strong. And while there are some great prizes from Q Workshop, Sword's Edge Publishing, Pulp Gamer, and Goodman Games listed on the contest page, there's also yet to be announced additions to the prize packages from Green Ronin, Paizo, and High Moon Media. So get over to the site, answer those questions, and win some prizes. The contest is officially over at the end of August, so don't bother waiting to the last minute. And I'll be giving you lots more information about the prizes and the companies who are bringing you the prizes as we progress through the contest. But now it's time to hear from, well, me. Oh, and William Paul also. As we continue our reviews of the 4th edition core rulebooks. Remember, if you like what you hear, stop on over at the Tome's Amazon store and buy the books. Doing so gets you the internet discount that we all sort of love, while still helping this show pay the bills. It's like the best of both worlds. Supporting a small little industry like this show, and getting awesome internet discounts. It's great. Okay, so we're back talking about the Dungeon Master's Guide for 4th Edition D&D. With me again is William Paul. This book is chock full of advice on running a game, running encounters, building adventures, campaigns, worlds, as well as an interesting DM's toolbox section, and the starting point for an adventure in the form of a town called Fallcrest. I liked a lot of the bits of advice that the book had. Usually I don't focus much on advice sections of books, at least not for personal use. You know, for the podcast, I usually read through them and give my thoughts or whatever. But for personal use, I don't focus much on advice bits because I've been gaming for 20 years. I've pretty much heard it all at this point. That said, as an experienced gamer, for the most part, I found these advice sections to be pretty interesting. The combat chapters were good. The sections on running a game were good. I really like the non-combat sections where they describe skill challenges and that kind of stuff that we can talk about later. So as an experienced gamer, I found a lot of the advice pretty good. There's a few areas where it got a little bit tiresome. Towards, you know, later on when it talks about building a campaign and building an adventure, some of the advice in there was better than others, but eventually, I guess towards the end, I got to a point where I was feeling like, okay, get on with it. Do I really have to read all this? You know, It sort of raises, I guess the longer and the more reading of advice that you provide, the more the barrier to entry is created for a DM. You know, they want to have lots of advice so a new DM knows exactly what to do and to do it well, but at the same time, it's sort of like, man, do I really got to know all of this to be a good DM? And if so, is it really worth it? You know, by making it more complex, they do sort of raise the barrier for entry for a new DM.
Possibly. I know that the one thing about being a new DM that the one comment that I would be able to make is from one of the guys I game with, and he's never run a game in any iteration of Dungeons and Dragons, not in any other role system, and he's decided that he's going to be the one running our first 4th edition game, and when he got a look at the Keep on the Shadowfell, when he was actually had a chance to read through the Dungeon Master's Guide, he's really excited to be running the game.
That's cool.
He said that after reading through the rules, reading through this book, that he actually is. He says he feels like he's going to be comfortable running this version of D&D rules as opposed to any other edition. And he's been gaming since D&D was first ever released.
Sure, you bet. I can definitely see that, and I would definitely agree. I just feel like you get to those last couple chapters, and it's sort of like, okay, at this point, you've already filled me with enough ideas that adventures and especially settings, I've already got all that stuff figured out in my head, you know? Because I've already, as I've been reading the rest of it, I've already sort of written all that in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And so it does get. I just think the end of it gets a little bit tiresome, but it is interesting to hear that perspective of it also, because you know I can't go back and be a new DM. I've already, that ship sailed a long time ago for me. So mm-hmm. It's interesting to hear that perspective. I like early on in the book they give some advice on resolving sort of unusual situations. They say you can't, you know, obviously have a rule in the book for every possible situations. So they give you just sort of a rule of thumb to keep in mind. I think it was called the rule of two, which basically just says, okay, they do something, you know, the PCs do something crazy that we can't account for. Give it a bonus or a penalty of two. You
know, mm-hmm.
If they do something, you know, if they leap up on the table and launch themselves off the table onto the floor, swinging their sword at the foe from behind as they do so, there's no rules for that. So give them, it's an interesting thing that would give them a benefit. Give them a +2 modifier. Done, easy, fair, taken care of. I also really like, they talk about the roles for monsters. The roles for monsters are different than the roles for classes. I like having that mix of roles to help build interesting encounters without having to put as much work into it as a DM. You know, I can just say 3 artillery and 4 brutes, there's an encounter.
And of course, sometimes when running encounters, you know, a DM might look at a monster or creature and have no idea how to use it. Right. And yeah, for example, I took part in one encounter where we were going up against I think it was a mind flayer at one point. And the DM running it basically treated it like it didn't have any psionic abilities. It was just up there using it as a fighter, essentially. And it was the easiest encounter with the Mind Flayer we'd ever run into.
Sure, because they didn't know how to run the Mind Flayer.
Well,
and I like that they include a short, easy-to-read tactics section in the Monster Manual, and we'll get to that when we talk about the Monster Manual, I guess. So once again, we're jumping ahead of ourselves. But yeah, I like the idea of the roles giving you at least a hint towards the tactics that monsters would use. Time's gonna tell. I'm a little concerned that as you play the game more and more, that's gonna make encounters become a little bit more stale, because there's basically just a small set number of tactics that all monsters use.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all monsters are either a soldier, a brute, artillery, controller, whatever they are, you know. And so there's only a set number of tactics. I think if the monsters have unique powers in the way they pull off those roles, that's where it might eliminate that problem. But we're going to have to play out a lot of games, I think, before we figure out, is this going to get stale, or do the powers make it unique enough to make that a non-issue?
There is definitely a big difference between just reading through the books and actually playing a couple sessions. That I do know, because I actually haven't had a chance to play any 4th edition, but I've read multiple posts on the internet in various forums where, you know, people who have had a chance to play do state that it is much different actually experiencing 4th edition rather than just reading through the book and conceptualizing it in your head.
Sure. And so obviously some of these things, time's going to tell, because you don't really know a system until you've really put it through its paces, and nobody's really had time to do that at this point unless you happen to be on the design team. I also really like the addition to the skill challenge system. It gives a specific structure to doing non-combat encounters in a way that a lot of indie games have sort of been doing for a while. I find the system a little bit restrictive in terms of role-playing. Sometimes I'd rather people just describe a situation and what they're going to do, and not worrying about specific rules or initiative and that kind of stuff to see if they pull it off. But then sometimes I think having a well-defined skill challenge system is going to make a lot of sense and actually make that part of the game very interesting.
And, I mean, from one perspective, I look at skill challenges and I say, yeah, of course, there's nothing new about skill challenges. This is exactly how we handled non-combat encounters in prior editions of the game, or at least within my group, where, you know, there was a confrontation, you know, we tried to negotiate, you know, our characters tried to negotiate with, you know, such and such NPC, and so based off what we said, what our characters said, the DM would say, okay, we'll roll this, and we're applying such and such modifier because of how you phrased your statement. And, I mean, it would be a succession of rolls. Now, of course, that was all, you know, homebrew, house rule generated.
Sure.
And so, of course, now that it is in the core book, it is listed in the rules is one method to do it.
And it's done a lot more specifically, you know?
It's all standardized.
Very standardized. And, you know, if it's this level of complexity, you need this number of successes before you have this number of failures. Boom. Done. We all know what the rule is, you know? And I think there's benefits to that and disadvantages to that also.
One thing that I did like in the DMG is the rules for diseases.
That was my very next note. I love the changes for diseases. I was just going to say that. They mentioned diseases and traps sort of in the same section. Traps, honestly, pretty much stay the same. Diseases, though, I absolutely love the way they did it. I like the way that diseases change over time. There's more stages to a disease now, you know? It might cause certain effects at this level, but if it gets worse, it's going to cause different effects.
Mm-hmm.
And that it all sort of goes through these different stages of progression until the disease either has some sort of permanent effect on you or you get over it. The disease system, while being very simple, comes off a lot more realistic. It's, I think, the best disease system D&D has ever had.
And there's so much room for expansion with diseases. People have said that in fourth edition, since, you know, we were talking about the healing surges earlier outside of combat, where you can heal back essentially to full health, you're, you know, back to perfect health after a combat. Well, what about someone that, you know, breaks their arm or has some lasting long-term injury? I remember there's, I think, Keith Baker, the creator of Eberron, posted on his blog where, you know, he gives a suggestion of, well, treat a broken arm or some type of long-term injury as a disease.
Sure. That makes sense.
And that definitely is one way that you would be able to have a lasting injury that your expenditure of healing surges wouldn't be able to get you around.
Sure. I think the DMG has a couple of areas where it's actually added a little bit more work for the DM. In most cases, it's made the job a little simpler. One of the areas where I think it's created a little bit more work is in the area of awarding treasure. They basically give you a set amount of treasure that you should give a party for each level. So there's, you know, within the first level of these characters, they should earn this much treasure. I think what that means is that as a DM, I need to spend more time at the beginning of each level figuring out what are the encounters going to be, when are they going to get the treasure. It's going to create a whole different type of prep that I wouldn't have done before. It's going to be a very different train of thought in terms of preparing these kinds of things, because I'm the kind of DM that likes to think these things out ahead of time, and if there's going to be a plus one short sword in the goblin's treasure hoard, the goblins are going to pick it up and use it. You know, that makes so much sense to me. So that means I'm going to have to do a lot of prep to figure out where within level one or level two or whatever does that plus one short sword fit in. So I think there's going to be a more of a long-term prep thought process when it comes to treasure that we're not quite used to yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, at this point when I got to the point of treasure placement and reading through that in the DMG, my eyes kind of just glazed over. I skipped ahead a couple pages, and my thought was, I'm glad I'm not the first 4th edition DM in my group.
Yeah. And I know William here has badmouthed in a previous review the idea of rewarding players with experience points when they're gone, even though that advice is given in the game. Although, personally, I have to honestly say that I disagree. I like the WotC approach a lot more. I like the approach that's in the DMG quite a bit. In my own games, I've gone even further and had a rule where everybody just has the same level of experience, period. Nobody's going to be a lower level. Nobody's going to be a higher level that way, because it's no fun being the player with the weakest member of the party, you know. And if you're going to be the super awesome player, you better do it through your actions, because in terms of numbers, you're equal to everybody else.
I think, and of course, the reasoning behind my comment in regard to that is, it's not so much that it's that the player's not there, the character's not there. It's that it's more so also taking into consideration the reasoning for them not to be there. If everyone knows ahead of time that, you know, hey, you know, one player's not going to be here, okay, we can plan for it accordingly. But if, you know, it's getting to be game time and one of your players that you haven't heard from, you know, if he hasn't give you forewarning that he's not going to be there and just he doesn't show up for the entire game session, and he's left everybody, you know, holding the bag, so to speak, just because, you know, he decided to be a jerk, you know, where he's still deserving of all the experience. So that's getting off into a really big different tangent. But
yeah, I think I'm not in the habit as a DM of trying to teach my players lessons, I guess. You know, and that sort of seems to be what that does. You know, you're punishing this person because they weren't responsible enough to show up. Well, you know, okay, but it's also a game, and we're all supposed to just be having fun. So I just sort of let things like, you know, if somebody blows off the game, I just sort of let it roll off my back and move on. And I'm not gonna punish them with less fun in the next game because they skipped out on us. And if it becomes a continuous problem, then you just talk to them about it, and if they can't solve the problem, find a new player, you know? And maybe that's also because I'm a teacher and I deal with teenagers all day, and so I do a lot of punishing and that kind of stuff throughout my workday. I don't want to have to be a teacher to my people I game with too.
Of course.
And that comment you made generated a lot of feedback for the show. I got several emails about that idea, and there's a thread over at the forum discussing that topic. So people should hop over there and give us their thoughts.
I guess I should check over on our forums as well.
I got several people that emailed me, and I told them to put it on the forums, and they never did. So, but there has been a lot of feedback on that. People had a lot of opinions about those thoughts in that situation. There's other areas where I think they've simplified things a lot too. For example, the third edition Dungeon Master's Guide had extensive rules for building towns and cities and communities and that kind of stuff, with rules about how much money they would have and what they can buy and that kind of stuff, very extensive economies. Fourth edition, they basically take the same idea, but they simplify it a ton. There are rules for towns. They're just broken down into broad categories and worry less about the specific details, but instead say, okay, this is a city. It's about this size. These are the kinds of things that you would find in this town. You know, this is the kind of town where you're going to find normal mundane equipment. This is the kind of town where you might run into an occasional magic item, or there might be a potion shop, you know. And they don't worry about the details of this town would have 2,574 gold pieces worth of goods available in town, and you need to keep track of all that. You know, they worry less about the details, and they worry more about the flavor, I guess, of how they're going to work. And I liked that. Although that part does actually give me one of my criticisms, I guess, of the DMG, is that there's a lot of crunch mixed in with the advice sections. And so I'm a little worried that when I want to find that crunch, I'm going to have a hard time finding it. You know, when I want to find the rules for how to build a town and a community, I'm not sure I'm going to be able to find that right away. In fact, I heard a review on another podcast, their first look at 4th edition, and they made the comment that there were no rules at all for towns, and so I went looking for it, and it's there. It's just not real easy to find. It's not real obvious like it was in the 3rd edition rules.
Hmm.
And then... go ahead.
Well, no, I was just about to say, I haven't... I must have not seen the details in regard to building a town either.
Yeah, see?
So it...
It's in there, but it's kind of buried.
Okay.
I sort of stumbled upon it actually this morning as I was finishing up reading some sections of the DMG. And then there's a section that I think is going to be one of the most used sections by DMs in the book, called the DM Toolbox. This is where I think a lot of DMs are going to go on a regular basis to help, mostly I think to help build encounters and to build monsters. Because this is where you find templates for monsters. It's not in the monster manual, they put it in the DMG. So you want to make a hobgoblin that's a lich, there's a template for that. But more interestingly, if you want to make a troll that's a cleric, there's a template for the classes. So you could have a cleric template added onto your monsters to make this troll feel like a cleric, or that orc feel like a warlord, or whatever the case may be. And I think that's a really interesting approach that, combined with the way they're doing monsters, is going to create a lot of really interesting variety.
I think that having options, having different... means of being able to change and adjust monsters and creatures that your players just might expect, you know, is definitely a good thing to have, you know, different flavors of the same creature and being able to be used different ways, adding this template, that template, whether it be just a... class or whatnot, that definitely is good to have, good to use. I agree that the DM toolbox definitely something that will definitely have a lot of use out of the DMG.
Well, I think the idea of having the class templates is particularly interesting because in previous versions, you know, if I was doing third edition, I would have to take the monster and then actually give it levels, you know, a certain number of levels in the cleric class or in the paladin class or whatever. Just being able to slap a template on real fast gives it that flavor of that class without having to do all the work of actually leveling a monster as a character.
And then actually, if you were to apply the full level, overpowering it from what you're trying to get it at the right encounter level 4.
Right. And then the last section of the DMG talks about Fallcrest, which is a possible starting location for your game. In my opinion, I don't really like these kinds of sections in a book. I tend to think it's largely wasted space. I kind of wish they would keep the extensive sample settings and sample adventures out of my books and put them all in one place. And, you know, I get the idea of giving some short examples. They actually, to demonstrate how something is done, they did a really good job of that with skill challenges. They gave some short examples that took one or two pages that honestly I think make skill challenges functional. Without those examples, I think skill challenges are very difficult to use. But I don't need pages and pages and pages stuck into my book for Fallcrest. Even if I use Fallcrest, I might probably use it one time. But I'm still going to have to lug those pages around in my book for years and years and years as I play 4th edition D&D in my DMG, and I'm never going to use them again. It's sort of become a standard practice for a lot of products to put a sample adventure or put a sample location in there. But personally, maybe it's because I'm an experienced player, but personally I find these sections to be largely page filler, and I wish they'd leave them out and only put things in there that are going to be useful forever.
I understand and agree somewhat with your perspective on this. What I think they possibly should have done with the page space is those rules for creating a town, creating your environment, you know, combine them, you know, put that information so you don't have to hunt through the DMG to find it, you know. Put that in this section here.
Yeah, or give us a decent index of several
that,
pages.
And then if you have to put Fallcrest in the DMG, well, put it in the player's handbook as well. Give the players their home base. There's information in the DMG about Fallcrest that, you know, they. You can't just hand this section of the DMG to your players and say, read this. This is where your character's from.
Yeah.
Because there's information the players aren't supposed to know within these pages.
I just think it would have made a lot more sense to make Fallcrest a web enhancement, you know, something like that. I can definitely see the use for it for some people to start off their first game or whatever. But it's going to be useful once at most. And once you've used it once, you're not going to come back to it. And it's just going to be wasted pages in your book that could have gone to something else.
And as far as your idea of a web enhancement, that would work well because you could have essentially two different versions of your web enhancement. One that's the player's handout, and then the second part that has DM advice, where it's like all the hidden information that, you know, this NPC has a hidden agenda, and this NPC, you know, has, you know, this information about them that
right.
is a secret.
Well,
which...
and I know they did the same thing with the Forgotten Realms campaign setting. They put a sample adventure in there, and it's the same sort of thing. I'm going to be lugging that campaign setting around to every Forgotten Realms game I run or play in. But I don't need that adventure but once at the most. And honestly, I normally don't run these sample adventures once, you know? So I kind of wish they'd leave them out, and if I wanted an adventure, I could go out and buy an adventure. I do that a lot. So I don't need it in the campaign setting. But all of that said, the DMG, I think, is a great improvement. If nothing else, I like the organization. I like the focus that the 4th edition DMG brings. It doesn't have anything in it that the players need at all. I cannot think of a single thing that I would need to get that book for if I was just going to play the game. But at the same time, it's very useful if you're going to DM. And so I like that focus. If you want to play D&D 4th edition, from what I can see so far, the only book you need to spend money on is the Player's Handbook. It's odd because I've talked to lots of people, and I don't think anybody's actually doing that. There's a lot of people I know that have never DM'd a game and never plan on DMing a game, but they're buying all three books.
Well, I think that's more the collector aspect of gamers. That they want the completeness. They want all the books.
But I think I really like the focus, and I really like that you can just get the one book, and you don't have to buy the DMG if you want to be a player.
And I'm not sure if you noticed this on the DMG, but just as I have the three books in front of me, and I'm just looking at the cover of the DMG, and I'm looking at the cover of the Player's Handbook.
Yeah, it has it inside there, doesn't it?
It has the little crystal ball that the red dragon on the DMG is looking into, has the two heroes, the actual image from the Player's Handbook, there in the crystal ball.
Yeah, I thought that was clever.
When I first saw that, I was just like, well, now, wait a second. Is there something on the Monster Manual cover that ties that into either of the other two books? And unfortunately not, that I could see.
That would have been neat, but I don't know how you could have done that organically. Like, it makes sense in the DMG with the scene that's on there.
Mm-hmm.
The Monster Manual, I think it might have been a little bit forced. But speaking of the Monster Manual, let's talk about that next. I think we can squeeze Monster Manual and DMG into one episode here, as long as we don't get on too many tirades.
Okay.
As far as the Monster Manual goes, I really like, I want to say this right up front, I really like a lot of what they did with the 4th edition Monster Manual. That said, of the three books, this one has the most things that I was disappointed in. And none of my complaints come out of the writing or the rules or the game design. I'm mostly disappointed with the organization and the artwork.
A lot of reused art from the 3.5 books?
Exactly. The art looks good. I'm not – well, there's a few pieces of art that I'm a little – I raise my eyebrow at. But for the most part, the artwork's really good. I was just disappointed to see that they were copy and pasting artwork directly out of 3rd edition books. You know, I expected better from a company like Wizards of the Coast. And it seems like they cut some corners.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I don't know if I'm necessarily unhappy about it, but slightly confused, is their choice of creatures and monsters to include in this Monster Manual that, you know, or sometimes it's kind of a given that you would expect to see it in the Dungeons & Dragons Monster Manual, like the metallic dragons.
Well, and they've talked a little bit about the reasoning for some of that. The reason that they put the monsters in that they wanted to put in, that they ended up putting in, is there was a couple of things. First of all, they wanted to include a large variety of monsters all the way from first level up to 30th level. And if you look at the index in the back where they actually list the monsters by level, they did a really good job of that. And I like that they did that. It allows for a wide variety of monsters to be used at every single level, because you can go a little bit above the party level, you can go a little bit below the party level. It narrows it down a little bit, I guess, when you're at early levels. You know, first and second level, you can't really go below first level. So you do have a little bit less variety there, but it provides a lot of variety. The second idea, I guess, that was in there was they only wanted to include things that you would actually be fighting, right? Metallic dragons are good creatures. Why would you be out there killing something that's good if you're the hero? And so they didn't put him in there. I think you're going to see him in later books. They just didn't want to put something in the Monster Manual that was only there for a role-playing purpose and doesn't really need combat statistics.
Well,
that was sort of the idea.
I mean, and of course, there's always the argument that not every single D&D game out there is, you know, so white and black. You know, the PCs are the heroes, and there's no gray area.
Well, and that's true, but 4th edition does seem to be sort of written with the assumption that you have a pretty black and white world.
And so I guess we'll just have to wait until that the next few monster manuals come out, next few source books come out for possibly a greater selection of.
You might see some metallics in the Draconomicon. I'm not sure what's going to be in there. There is a book coming out all about dragons.
I believe that is strictly chromatic dragons.
I think you're right. Yeah.
And it actually indicates that it would be introducing three new chromatic dragons.
Correct. So, yeah.
But I'm sure that the missing monsters will be in future supplements. It's just it kind of caught me off guard that, okay, well, I kind of expected that
they'd be there.
Yeah. And, of course, metallic dragons aren't the only ones that, you know, I noticed in their absence.
Sure. And
that's just the first one.
That's sort of related to my next note here, where they've cut down the text for each creature to try to pack more creatures into the book as a whole. So they've given you just the basic information that you need to run this creature in a combat, which is awesome, because if I'm running a fight, I don't want to have to do a lot of reading to find the parts that I need. However, it means that there's less to read to understand where this creature fits into a living, breathing, social, organized world, you know, a dynamic world that has different races and different civilizations and that kind of stuff. It's harder to figure out where do these creatures fit in, because we don't know anything about their sociology or about their physiology or about any of that kind of stuff that used to be provided.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get any information even about how they look other than the artwork. So if you don't like the artwork, you don't know how they look, you know?
Now, what I think would be interesting is if, as a companion book to the Monster Manual, Wizards of the Coast would put out a book that does have that ecology of the monsters.
Well, and I wonder if they're not going to do that with books like the Draconomicon. I wonder if that's not going to be a lot of what the Draconomicon does, is give you a lot of that background detail information about how to make these things work.
Mm-hmm. That, or possibly a, and honestly I have no idea what they would call it, but if the Monster Manual is to combat encounters, have a book that it would be essentially a Monster Manual-like for your skill challenges.
For your non-combat, sure. Well, and they sort of have a vehicle to do that because they have Dragon Magazine on D&D Insider. They could always use the ecology articles.
That's true.
To flesh out a lot of that stuff, assuming they continue with the ecology articles. I also like that they give you, in the appendix, they give you a lot of the monstrous races that you could, with statistics to use them, that you could use to make PC monsters. For a lot of the races. Now, the intention of that section is to give DMs something to make interesting NPC monsters that would help give a lot of that background that we just talked about. You know that that's going to turn into a big reason for players to buy the Monster Manual. A lot of players are going to buy this Monster Manual because there's three pages in the back or two pages in the back or whatever it is that give you, you know, 15 more playable races.
I would expect that most players that pick up the Monster Manual for these additional races would probably pick it up for the third race listed of Drow.
Right.
And Drow are very popular, much to my confusion, but...
Yeah. Well, it's R.A. Salvatore's fault.
So you want to give him the blame, not the credit?
Well, either way. I love Drizzt. Don't get me wrong. I buy every novel he writes, and I read them all. But I think he's definitely the one who gets both the blame and the credit.
Okay. I know that, you know, personally, looking through these this list of PC race monsters – I personally am interested in possibly rolling up a Minotaur or an Orc character.
Sure.
But
now, I also mentioned earlier on that I have problems with the organization with the book a little bit, because some creatures are categorized in ways that I think are going to make them very difficult to find when I want to find them. And my prime example is the Abomination category, which stands out because it's the second page of the book, or, you know, the second monster listed.
Mm-hmm.
But it contains creatures that are demonic, or at least demonic in flavor. It contains creatures that are undead, and it contains the Tarrasque. Now, without delving very deeply, there's not any obvious connection as to why all these monsters should be lumped together in the same page of the book. You look closer and you realize that they've sort of created a story about how all these creatures were created as weapons of the gods, but they didn't quite work out very well and they became these abominations. So it makes sense if you sort of follow along that storyline, but if I'm thinking as a DM, hey, I need to find the Tarrasque, I'm going to be looking under T, not A.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no index of alphabetically listed monsters. There's not even one in the table of contents. You can't turn the table of contents and find the Tarrasque. There's just an entry for abomination. So you just have to know that the Tarrasque is an abomination. Otherwise, there's no easy way to find it. So that's my big organizational problem, is that some of the categories are confusing and the lack of an index or thorough table of contents makes it even more confusing.
I can definitely agree with you there, because just as you were saying that, I did flip to the table of contents, and sure enough, as you mentioned, no mention of the Tarrasque. Now, to their credit, the Tarrasque is listed in the index, where all the monsters are listed by level.
Yeah.
But,
and I suppose when I'm building an encounter, I'm probably going to be looking at those charts by level anyway, and that does give a page number, so that might actually work out okay. I just wish, if I knew there was a monster I wanted to find, I wish there was an easier way to find it, besides just happening to know what category they stuck them in. So, but anyway, there is also a lot of focus in the book on different varieties for different creatures. You know, almost every creature has more than one variety now. You don't ever just find an orc, okay? You've got different types of orcs. This makes a ton of sense in my mind for any creature with even a little bit of intelligence. Variety makes a lot of sense. Some of them would try to fight one way, some of them would try to find a different way. In some cases, it seems like they've added variety just for the sake of adding variety. And yes, I'm looking at you, gibbering orb. I don't see how gibbering orb is necessarily necessary. The gibbering mouther had that situation pretty much covered without the gibbering orb getting involved. But having a variety of different orcs and goblins and humans and hags and golems and trolls and spiders and mummies and all that kind of stuff makes a lot of sense to me, and I think is going to be add an interesting dynamic to the game, because then you see a hobgoblin, but you still don't know what to expect, because what kind of hobgoblin is that?
Definitely.
The only other thing that sort of stuck out to me is that Orcus is made a big deal in the book. Now, I love.
He's there on the cover.
Right. I love Orcus, so don't get me wrong. You know, at least as much as anybody can love a demon lord of the undead. But other than maybe the Tarrasque, there is not any use of unique creatures in the entire book other than Orcus. You know, everything that's there is an orc, and these are different types of orcs. Or this is a human. These are different types of humans. This is a gibbering beast, and here are the three different kinds of gibbering beasts, or whatever it is. But then you get to Orcus, and then it's like, and here's Orcus. Boom. Done. There's just one of him, ever, anywhere. You know? It seems like, because basically they've given you an NPC.
And
rather than a monster.
Possibly they did that as a means of providing an example of a unique NPC opponent.
Yeah, and I think that's sort of what they were going for. I think they wanted to make it so that you could, you know, you didn't have to buy the manual of the planes. You could look at the core books and say, okay, here's this. This is how a majorly powerful villain would sort of fit in. And create a central theme. I mean, there's a whole theme built around Orcus. There's other creatures that aren't even real. Some of them aren't even really other creatures. Some of them are just humans that are cultists of Orcus, you know?
But then if that is what their goal was with Orcus, then, you know, to have an example of a unique NPC opponent, then why leave that at the high end of the epic tier? I could see them possibly having, you know, have one set at level 10, at level 20, at, you know, the high end of each of the tiers.
I almost get the impression that they gave you, I mean, if you look at the entry for Orcus, they actually have a fairly wide range of different leveled creatures, starting at the low level with, you know, human cultists, and working your way up to his lieutenants, and then all the way up to Orcus himself. So I almost feel like they gave you this entry on Orcus so you could build your own campaign themed around Orcus and play from first level to 30th level and have some thematic creatures all along the way. I almost feel like this entry would have been better suited for the DMG. You know, pull out Fallcrest and give me this entry on Orcus as a sample of this is how you can thematically create NPCs for your campaign. You know, that almost would have made more sense to me. But ultimately, yeah. I mean, it's a section that's going to get used, and I don't have a huge issue with it. It's just, it's definitely a case of one of these things is not like the other. You know, it just doesn't quite belong.
Possibly they could put out an entire monster manual filled with unique NPC opponents that Orcus could have been on the cover of, as opposed to this book.
Sure. Well, and they are doing a manual of the planes that I think is going to give us a lot of those, you know, demon lords and arc fiends and that kind of stuff. So I think we're going to get a lot of that, and obviously Orcus is going to play a role in that. I'm assuming, well, I don't know, they may just reprint his stats over again in there. We'll have to wait and see.
And, of course, the one minor hope I have in regard to a manual of the planes book is, please, for the love of God, don't stat out the Lady of Pain.
I like the Lady of Pain.
Yeah, but you, that is one NPC you definitely do not need stats for.
Oh, I suppose, yeah. And they mention her. What was that? Was that in the DMG? It was in one of the books. They actually mentioned Sigil
and
Lady Pain. So I was impressed that they didn't just completely abandon the Planescape concept. But all in all, Monster Manual, I think, is an improvement over the third edition Monster Manual. They've learned some things along the ways, and it has a lot of unique possibilities. It more completely gives you creatures to use spread throughout all the levels. You know, you've got more creatures at every level that you can use. You've got a lot of variety to use. Combine this with the templates in the DMG, and you can really throw things for a loop and honestly not have to put a lot of prep and a lot of work into it. So all in all, I think they did a really nice job with the Monster Manual, even though of the three books, it was the one I had the most problems with.
Overall, you know, once I believe I said this as far as my consensus thought when I had my first read, the first glance, is that overall for the three core books, it's a good start. Very good start. You know, books very nice, very well laid out. I agree as far as the organizational issues on the Monster Manual, but it's just like after the wealth of information available for 3.5, I'm just, yeah, you know, part of me wants to get back to having that amount of information available to me for 4th edition now.
Yeah, and it'll get there. All in all, for 4th edition as a whole, I would definitely recommend it, but I would once again reiterate that if you're going to play 4th edition, seriously, listen to us and listen to the people at Wizards. You do not need to buy all the books. Buy the Player's Handbook and play some awesome 4th edition. If you're going to run 4th edition, then get all three books and you're going to have a really good start towards, I think, some really fun games. Do you have any final thoughts?
No final thoughts here.
Okay. Then this has been our review of the 4th edition core books, and I hope you enjoy, and I hope I get these out before Origins.
You enjoy Origins, Jeff.
I will. Well, okay, there's the 4th edition Dungeon Master's Guide and Monster Manual. I know I had a blast on my first game session using these new rules. If you've played, please swing by the forums at thetomeshow.com and let us know how it went. Or, if you want to read about how it's gone for others, you're welcome to stop by too. Now a quick promo for RPGpodcast.com, because, well, there's a bunch of great podcasts out there on gaming, and this is a great site to find them all. Plus, I sort of just made a bunch of new promos for RPGpodcast.com, and I want to get them out there. While it's true this show might be the staff of noble strength of gaming podcasts, sometimes you just need a good +2 dire mace to bash them over the head. Find the right tool for the job at RPGpodcast.com. That's episode 67. And hey, why don't you email the show at thetomeshow@gmail.com and let us know what you think, or if you agree, disagree, or are confused by something in this episode, go ahead and hop over to the forums at thetomeshow.com. Also, you can help the show get noticed with reviews or votes on various sites. But more than that, get out there and tell people about the show. Hop on Twitter, gaming email lists, or forums that you visit and just tell folks, hey, have you heard about thetomeshow.com? It's got D&D news, reviews, interviews, plus they're running a really easy contest right now. You should check it out. Maybe you'll win something. Also, don't forget to check out the Tome's Amazon store for products discussed on this show and more. The show gets part of the proceeds, and that helps keep us on the air. And once again, you can find all of that at thetomeshow.com. And of course, don't forget to support our cooperating podcasts, Fistful of Comics and Games, and Gamer's Haven. Links for things mentioned in this show can be found in the show notes on the website at thetomeshow.com. This has been episode 67, 4th edition Dungeon Master's Guide and Monster Manual of
The Tome.